yell at anybody.
Yay!
But also, we'll just try to take it through, and I'd ask people not to try to talk over my voice. Second of all is that we have a lot on the on the schedule today, and so I'm going to ask people to keep their testimony short. Of the bills that we're going to go through, I want to do it in the following order. First, I want to do the Coos Bay, the South Slough issues, and move through them fairly quickly. I don't want to. I want to give everybody a chance to testify, but if we're going to pass the bill, then let's not overkill the testimony. On annexation, I have two people that have signed up on Senate Bill 887. We had a lengthy hearing on this a week or two ago. I'm happy to take some short testimony, but my goal is not to open up another lengthy hearing on annexation. And then after that, we'll move into the school impact fee system development charge bills. So that's how I'm hoping that we're going. And so let's go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 857. Senator Verger, and who else would you like to bring with you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Joanne Berger from State Senate District Number 5. Today with me is Mike Graybill, the Executive Director for the South Slough Estuary, and Ann Hannes from the Department of State Lands. As you know, this is a partnership with the State of Oregon. Senate Bill 857 is an ecotourism visionary bill that also has a little bit of a property rights component to it. It allows the South Slough Estuary to expand, and they can buy property from a willing seller. They've done wonderful things. First estuary established in the United States. They have an educational outreach, a wonderful interpretive center, and they also, you can kayak and walk on their wonderful trails. We are proud of it, but we have a vision of ecotourism. And because I have some wonderful people here that know about this and work with it every day, I'm going to be very brief, and I will allow another person to take this chair, Mr. Chair, as I turn it over to Mike Graybill.
Let me talk.
Just go ahead.
Initially, my name is Ann Hannes, Director, Department of State Lands. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 857. South Slough National Reserve is part of the Department of State Lands. It was established back in 1974 as the first national estuary and reserve. It has it has several key functions. It does research, key research for the coastal communities. It's also engaged with education, where thousands of school kids come to South Slough each year, as well as has a stewardship function where it's engaged in restoration. Let me talk specifically about this bill. The bill changes the statutory description for South Slough. It does not, in and of itself, change the boundary. The boundary would only be changed, one, if there would be a willing seller, two, if it complies with the South Slough plan that was developed, I should add, with extensive local input and review, and with the approval of the South Slough Commission. And three, there's a legislative approval of the expenditure of the funds. One of the things that I'm very excited about that South Slough has been engaged with recently is working with the Charleston community and the Charleston merchants to develop a joint project called the Charleston Gateway Project. This would be located in Charleston, just on the south side of the bridge, and if we would receive federal money, that is. The problem, though, is that we can't receive that federal money without having that parcel be part of the South Slough. And in fact, we were just recently turned down for money that we had applied for that purpose. Anyway, this bill, if it would pass, would allow us to go back to the to NOAA in the next round of grants and ask again for that money, and it would improve our chances, I think, significantly to try to get that money, and that would be a great boost to that community and help the efforts to further their economic development pursuits. The South Slough Management Commission did vote to support Senate Bill 857, and we also support amendments that are proposed today by Senator Verger. These amendments would add an east-west and south boundary and make a northern boundary more specific to address some of the concerns that we've heard from locals, such as the port. I can show you the map right here. What would be proposed with the amendments is to have the border follow the watershed, but also, but more specifically on the northern part, it would stop short of the Charleston Bridge, but allow a little piece of property that's right there for the Charleston Gateway Project, and then follow along the Joanne Slough, but would stop short of going into where the port is. So I think what that does is provide a more definitive boundary to South Slough.
Excuse me, Steve. Could he pass that around so we can look at it closer?
Sure.
And I could have Mike answer any specific questions that you might have regarding that. So in summary, if this bill passes, I believe that it's going to be a boost for the economy of Charleston, as well as be consistent with the goals of South Slough. But again, it will not in itself change the boundary. It only allows a willing seller, also if it complies with the South Slough plan, and also if the legislature appropriates the funds to be able to acquire any land. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Would you like to go ahead?
Thank you, Senator Ringo, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Mike Grayville. I'm the manager of the South Sioux Reserve in Charleston. That's the subject of this bill. Senator Verger has just asked me to clarify briefly what the mission of the reserve is. We are a 31-year-old research natural area that is focused on improving our understanding of estuaries throughout the state. This place was created in partnership with the federal government, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, in 1974 by an act of the Oregon Legislature, and became the first site in what is now a system of 26 sites throughout the U.S. that's focused on improving the management of our coastlines. In this case, we're about a 5,000-acre a piece of real estate that is a portion of one inlet on the Coos Bay estuary, and we've been engaging in a series of education programs, research programs, and stewardship programs that are really focused on improving the management throughout the state. Some of the major activities that we've been involved in are public education and outreach. Previous speakers have already spoken about our tourism activities. We have a visitor information center, but we also are involved in K-12 education programs, and actually we call them K-to-gray education programs, with adult learning as well. And we're also engaged in a program of research that has principally focused on helping to provide additional information to support fisheries such as the role that salmon play in wetland restoration areas and water quality issues that relate to our recreational and our commercial shellfish industries in the estuary. And finally, our stewardship program has just been working to make sure that the investment that the public has made in this place is well looked after. And those stewardship programs have really helped us focus on habitat restoration work, also trying to get a better understanding of how non-native species, marine invaders, work in the saltwater environment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Why don't you go ahead?
My name is David Ford, and I'm a resident of Charleston. I have submitted two letters of recommendation for the bill. One is from former representative and former Coos County Commissioner Jim Whitty. He's in full support of Senate Bill 857. The other one is from Coos County Commissioner Nikki Whitty, who is very much in favor of the Gateway Project and the way 857 would help allow this to happen. She is worried in the letter, if you read it, about it becoming a political football in some ways, but she is very much in support of the Gateway Project. I live in what would be the expanded boundary for the South Sioux Estuary, and I also have commercial property in Charleston, and I recognize the reserve as a good business neighbor, and that this project, which would be very important for establishing not just administrative offices for the reserve, but also as a visitor center for Charleston, would be very helpful in promoting the businesses of Charleston.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming all the way from Coos Bay. Peg Regan and Cam Perry, please. And also a Melody Caldera. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Ringo and members of the committee, my name is Peg Regan. I live at 97305 Signal Butte Trail, Gold Beach, Oregon. I'm here before you in support of Senate Bill 857. This legislation is necessary to allow a new northern limit for the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve. It won't change the reserve's objective of education and research. It's not a regulatory program, but it will allow the reserve to purchase land from a willing seller and expand appropriately. As you know, it was the legislature 30 years ago that created the South Slough Sanctuary. I was first involved with the South Slough 15 years ago when I was a Curry County Commissioner. I worked with them and the Bureau of Land Management to create OCEAN, the Oregon Coastal Education and Awareness Network on the South Coast. The South Slough has been good for the South Coast, and it's been good for the state. Thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and continue with the panel.
Thank you, Senator Ringo and members. My name is Melody Caldera. I'm from Coos Bay. I'm a lifetime member or lifetime resident of Coos Bay, and I'm in support of this Senate bill. And I would just like to say that our Coos River is not a really big river, but somehow we ended up with a very big estuary at Coos Bay. And please keep in mind that 89% of it has been diked and filled, and our estuaries are our daycare centers for the ocean fisheries, really. And 89% of that's been taken away. I feel like South Slough is just a pristine and wonderful area to study how important estuaries are and to help educate children and our coming generations. And it has been a set aside for that, and I would very much encourage you to move forward with this bill so that Mike could do an even better job of taking care of what's there and promoting that education.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Perry.
Chairman Ringo, members of the committee, thank you so much for having us here today. I'd like to talk a little bit about the economic aspects of what this bill will help us with down in Coos County. I've been a travel and outdoor writer for the past 30 years, so I write extensively about the travel industry, and in particular, ecotourism. And what's interesting to us is that ecotourism has become a $145 billion a year industry worldwide, with over half of that money spent yearly in North America. The Canadian government recently undertook a very extensive and exhaustive research project focusing on ecotourism in the Pacific Northwest, and they found that ecotourists spent an average of 50% more than regular tourists and stayed four times longer in an area, and that is why South Slough is of particular interest to all of us in Coos County. They also found out that 7 million Americans a year are willing to spend $3,000 each on a nature or ecotourism trip. That's a pretty significant amount of money when you start to tabulate it. Currently, over 20,000 visitors a year see the South Slough, and that's virtually without any national marketing whatsoever, just local and statewide outreach. So what we have is a tremendous economic engine and possibility within Coos County to help us in our economic turnaround. One of the big problems Detroit has is when they lose an automaker, they have to invent another industry to replace it when they have an economic downturn. In Oregon, we are very fortunate because we have an existing industry in ecotourism, which is very strong in the South Slough and Coos County area, but we can expand upon it tremendously. If we make the investment that 857 asks by okaying a potential expansion of the South Slough area, we're protecting a spectacular area for our children and our children's children and helping to foster a diverse and strong economy for all of Oregon. And that's why I ask you to proudly support this bill, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? For the record, your name is
Cam Perry.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your coming here to testify.
Thank you.
Liz Frankel. And we only have another 2 minutes on this bill here.
Ms. Frankel for the League of Women Voters, and there is absolutely nothing I can add to the wonderful testimony. I have written testimony before me. The League of Women Voters of Oregon supports this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Committee staff, could you inform us on the Dash 1 amendments? We want to see them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the proponents brought forth the Dash 1 amendments earlier this afternoon. And all these do is define a little more specifically what the boundary of the area that we're talking about is.
Okay.
Do you want me to?
And you want us to pass the Dash 1 amendments?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, let's go ahead and close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 857. Chair moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 857. Is there any discussion?
Okay,
not yet. Okay. Is there any objection? So ordered. And Chair moves Senate Bill 857 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't be supporting the motion for a bunch of reasons, but primarily it's converting private land into public land. We have enough problems with tax base. We already have too much public land in our state as far as I'm concerned. Let's see how else we go. They're funding this out of the common school fund, which takes money away from schools. It's going to cost more money out of the common school fund to fund it for a variety of reasons. All we know.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Okay. Katie, could you go ahead and call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Rigo?
Aye. Motion passes. Senator Shields, would you like to carry the bill?
Unless
Senator Verger, let's let you carry the bill.
Thank you.
Okay, great. And let's go ahead and open a public hearing then on Senate Bill 887. We had a couple of witnesses. Linda Ludwig, why don't you start? Linda, are you here?
She was right outside a second ago.
Okay. I've got folks from Mike Wendell from Prineville, Eileen Stein from Sisters, Alan Unger from Redmond. We've talked before. You're happy to place your testimony on the record, but you're going to have to be brief.
Right. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Ringo and committee. My name is Alan Unger, Mayor of Redmond. This is Mike Wendell, Mayor of Prineville. We're here for Central Oregon Cities Day. It's a three-hour drive over a snowy pass. We just want to say that Central Oregon is a fast-growing area, and Deschutes County is one of the fastest in the country. One-size annexation doesn't work for everybody. We need flexibility to move forward with breast growth with the new people coming to Central Oregon and to be fair with our current residents. We are elected to provide services. We need flexibility to create the right solutions for our different communities. Please work with us, cities, okay. Central Oregon, and League, as you move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sure. You said it well. Linda.
Oh, let me catch my breath here.
Mr. Chair, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. You've heard my testimony about this bill a couple of weeks ago, and are we looking at the Dash 3 amendments today?
Yes, we are.
Thank you. The League has no choice but to vigorously oppose these amendments in this bill, being that these amendments, intended to or not, are a thinly disguised prohibition on all island annexations. And the amendment, in our perspective, in our eyes, is anti-economic development, anti-land use planning program, anti-environment, anti-local planning efforts, and causes inefficient public-private investments of state and local resources. We believe that the island annexation portion of this bill is being driven by a situation in Beaverton. a situation we're all very aware of, which is unusual and could be dealt with in a manner that would not greatly penalize the other cities and their taxpayers throughout the state. Many of the islands in Beaverton's case were created by annexing right-of-ways and publicly owned properties, such as the parks owned by Tualatin and Hills Park and Rec, and fire stations owned by Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. It's those streets that create the dots that have been responsible for creating this unusual situation there. One of the solutions we would believe that wouldn't harm all the rest of the cities would be an exception to island annexation laws that would require the property being proposed for the island annexation be islanded by more than a street.
Just another minute, please, Linda.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, I just want to point out the bill now creates a potential horrific situation for island annexations that already have been done. If you'll see in Section 1, Sub 1, Sub A, the language as of January 1, 2005. If these island annexations already have occurred, infrastructure free, which never occurs, they may be in legal limbo land. And the amendment opens the door, we believe, for some appeals of those annexations. The city of Albany is one. They moved forward in November in the election with a island annexation, recently proclaimed it, and their attorney is very, very concerned that this date here is going to, whether it's unintended or just poorly written, cause them some heartburn with the certification by the Secretary of State's office of that annexation.
Just Linda, I'm sorry. You'll need to wrap it up, please.
Thank you. I have to be very, very clear. The League cannot support these amendments, and we're very concerned for the other 239 cities within the state of Oregon.
Thank you. I mean, just a couple comments. I have an email. Senator Ringo, I live in the Roseburg area, and I'm impacted by the threats of annexation similar to those of Beaverton area residents. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 887. This is from Roseburg. Sincerely, Roger Johnson. I think there are people all over the state that are concerned about forced annexation, and this is certainly not a Beaverton-only issue. The second point is that, as you know, I spent the last 3 weeks working with you very closely, and I've done my best to come to terms with you, and I've received different indications as we've moved along. I think that as this bill moves out of the Senate and towards the House, that there will be time for more discussion. And I don't think that a one-size-fits-all in Oregon works very well. That's not the intent of this bill. But this is a statewide problem, and it needs a statewide solution. And I hope to work with you in the next 8 weeks to at least hone this bill in that period of time. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, if you're inviting me for a comment, I hope very much to be able to give it.
Thank you.
Yes, that is extremely fair, and I do acknowledge we have had many conversations about annexation. And I think I hope it was a surprise to us when we saw this language last night, some of the things that were in here that potentially had legal implications that I am concerned about. For the record, if any of the committee members would like to entertain just clarification of what the intent of that January 1, 2005 date was, it might help the city of Albany quite a bit in terms of legislative intent.
We'll be glad to work on that. Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
I gathered that it was true, but I'm gathering that the mayors of Redmond and Prineville are also opposed to the amendments?
Yes, we are. We support the League's position.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I had several people signed up. Vicki Woods, if you could come forward, please. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Ringo, members of the committee. My name is Vicki Woods. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Salem. I know that you had testimony on the earlier version of this bill a couple of weeks ago, so I will keep my comments as brief as I can. As a Community Development Director of the city, I am in charge of all land use planning and building permitting for the city, and I've been a planner in the state of Oregon for 9 years and a planner generally for 25 years. And I won't go into the details of how important annexation is to cities as an economic development tool, but I do want to just go on record that the amendments to the bill cannot be supported by the City of Salem, that it's critical to us that we have some tools available to us to encourage annexation and to encourage economic development, that we are able to take advantage of the investment that we have made in trying to plan for the full growth of our city and put those tools in place and have those facilities available so that when we do construct the kind of infrastructure we construct, counting on all of the land within our urban growth boundary to be annexed, that we are able to take advantage of that over time. And so I would ask that you please not support the amendments to this, that if it is important that there be some limits on annexation, that they not apply as broadly to all cities, but rather be targeted to specific areas where there may be the most concern.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Jim Seabury.
Chairman Ringo, members of the committee, for the record, I live in the unincorporated area of the city of Eugene in a community which a lot of people call shotgunned, and that's Santa Clara and River Road. These are places that are not blighted. Just recently, the problem that we have there has all to do with street annexations forming islands. And I was ill one day when you were having testimonies, and I listened to the committee and the people giving testimony, and they brought up the fact that the streets normally were done in two pieces with a time span in between them. That's exactly what happened in one particular case I'm very knowledgeable on, and that is that there's 58 homes, and those 58 homes, probably in the $300,000 range, gorgeous places, have, since they annexed 5 acres just west of those 58 homes, and had previously annexed Santa Clara Avenue in two pieces, are now held hostage. Where one day those people had vote, if we were going to do a 195 annexation, they would have had voice and vote. What happened was they lost their vote when they became an island. Those people had no say because they were deemed by the Boundary Commission to have they're non-affected by what had happened. Person loses his vote and he's non-affected. And this is not just true there. They've recently, Ladera Street, when we went to the Boundary Commission with that, 20 people gave testimony. They not only did they annex the street in front of the voluntary annexation, but they annexed all of Ladera Street, which is now 0.1 miles from a later annexation of a street. Call it superfluous annexations, if you wish, of streets.
Just another minute, Mr. Seabury, I'm sorry.
Pardon?
Just another minute, please.
Oh. So what I'm saying is that these amendments, since people seem to be against them, they can't be doing harm at all, as far as I see. And I'm all in favor of 887. And I think that we should give people that have properties rights. And that's why I'm here.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay, Michael, could you come on up and just introduce the -3 amendments, please? Go ahead.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio. For the record, I'm employed with Senator Charlie Ringo as a staff member here in the Oregon Senate. And I am going to be introducing the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 887. And then I will take questions from the committee regarding their technical effects. Firstly, there's been discussion regarding Oregon's existing annexation law. Very, very briefly, the two major chapters that are most relevant to this discussion, Chapter 195 and Chapter 222, are both affected. Non-metro cities annex exclusively. I'm sorry, metro cities annex exclusively under 222. Non-metro cities have the run of both of those chapters. Within those chapters, there are two loopholes that do not require input from the target territory being annexed. That is the entire Chapter 195, which is a single majority. It requires the combined a vote of the combined city and target territory. And if a majority is clear, then the annexation becomes successful. There would be an addition of a dual majority to that under the Dash 3 amendments to 887, whereby the vote in the territory would also have to clear 50% for the annexation to be successful up until that was sunsetted. The other loophole...
And that sunsets in 2 years.
That does. That sunsets.
Okay.
For the record, it's 2 years and change. The other provision being affected under the Dash 3 amendments is ORS Chapter 222, Section 750. That is the infamous islands annexation that has been discussed. This is the loophole that is accessible to metro cities. Any other metro annexation requires either a dual majority, whereby the territory being annexed must also clear 50%, or it requires some form of consent by the territory being annexed. The Dash 3 amendments have three main points. The temporary moratorium on those two loopholes until January 2008. The encouragement of annexation is certainly not placed under that moratorium. It's still allowed. The mandating of annexation is put on hold. The second point in Senate Bill 887-3 is the provisions exempting certain industrial lands near the city of Beaverton. These areas are the Nike campus and Columbia Sportswear, which have recently been encircled by the city of Beaverton and are now subject to island annexation. The third point under the Dash 3 amendments is the establishment of a work group under the Joint Land Use Committee during the interim. The composition of that work group is outlined in the bill. That work group is expected to suggest lasting reforms to the 07 legislature, which would take effect hopefully before the moratorium was lifted in January of 08. I want to be clear regarding the provisions of the Dash 3 amendments that it does not make it any more difficult to annex land whereby the landowner or the residents in that land are willing to be annexed. It does not make consensual annexation any tougher. And I do appreciate the League of Cities' suggestion that island annexation stipulations need to be incorporated. And I'm sure that if I'm still working here, I will be more than willing to discuss that with Linda and bring that up in the work group.
Thank you very much. Is there questions from the committee? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. As regard to the date on in Section 1 of the bill, January 1st, 2005, that's in Chapter 222, which you said is strictly and only metro cities. The concern raised by Linda Ludwig was an Albany pass annexation, and it's in limbo because of that date. But Albany is not a metro city. Is that?
I'm sorry, I may have misspoken. The 222 is accessible to all cities in the state of Oregon. Metro cities are restricted from the use of ORS 195. There should be a handout, the last page of the four pager that should be on all your desks, except you, Charlie. Is a list of annexation procedures that are available to metro and non-metro cities. Non-metro cities have all of those options checked.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 887. Open a work session on Senate Bill 887. Chair moves the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 887. Is there any discussion? Okay. At this point, we're just moving the amendments, but that's fine. Any other discussion?
I guess I just a question. Having heard the testimony now, and I recognize you've been working quite hard on this, I had not. But it seems like your intention is to continue to morph this bill as it moves forward.
Senator Beyer, I very much want to continue working on this. I think annexation is incredibly complex, and that's why really we need the two-year task force to look at it. But even between now and how the bill eventually comes out of the House, I hope to continue to work with the League of Cities and all interested parties on this, because if there are issues on this bill where it's demonstrated it would cause a city a problem, an unintended consequence, I certainly don't want that to happen. I want economic development to happen. The cities came and explained and testified that there might be some consequences to economic development. I don't think they made their case, but I think we need to continue talking. And I am pretty confident that what we would pass out of the committee today would not be the bill that would eventually become law. I would certainly expect amendments in the House and the conference committee.
Okay.
Any other discussions on the dash threes? Katie, could you call the roll on the dash threes?
Senator Byers?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Aye.
Chair Ringo?
Aye. So the dash threes have passed. Chair moves Senate Bill 887 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Senator Atkinson.
Well, Chair, as we talked about, I don't really like this bill in this form. I'm all for keeping pressure on to keep the process moving in the sense that we've got to either hear this bill or kill it now. I think there is an issue going on in Redmond. I don't believe one size fits all, but I'm willing to let the bill go, knowing that I get a crack at it again on the floor, and knowing that if these issues aren't resolved, it'll either die in the House or come back in conference. So it is a departure from my personal policy to do things right now, which is how they should be done, but the chair has asked for me to give a courtesy vote, and that's how it'll help the process continue.
I appreciate that, Senator Atkinson. Any other Senator Shields?
Yes, I just kind of want to be on record that the mayor of Happy Valley has indicated that Happy Valley won't be near so happy if I vote for this. And it does make me a little nervous. I guess I would kind of reiterate some of what Senator Atkinson said, but I'll stick with my chair today and help get this out of here. Knowing that we're going to have a few more cracks at it.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I wanted to claim my no vote. I want to commend the chair for your hard work on this, and I think I also commend your efforts to keep working on this. As a former commissioner on the Land Conservation and Development Commission, I'm just a strong believer in annexation as a tool for management of services and land use planning and transportation planning and everything else within urban growth boundaries. It's a very strong philosophical position I have, and I would have been willing to help move this along, but I'm very comfortable with my position on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the work you've done. Like I said, I have not spent the time looking at it. There's parts of the bill I like. There's parts of the bill I don't like. I need to get moving because I got an appointment at 3:45. I'll probably vote no today. I may vote yes on the floor. I just haven't had a chance to look at it that much, but I don't feel comfortable moving a bill that I know isn't right.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, just as a comment from the chair, there were bills that were introduced in this session that were a lot more aggressive than this. There were bills that would have mandated a dual majority vote in all circumstances.
I like that one.
What's that? Senator Schrader and Senator Beyer and Senator Westman introduced that bill. And there was no two-year moratorium involved. There was no study group involved. So I think this is the moderate approach. So we can step back, take a deep breath, and carefully solve a problem. But I think for a lot of areas of the state, we have to do that because they are in danger of unjust annexations. And it's important that we do something this session. In working with the League of Oregon Cities, it's been a moving target. It's impossible to get a read as to what they will agree to, and that's been my difficulty. So I appreciate your comments, and I agree with them. So I can't do this. So Katie, could you go ahead and call the roll?
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Mr. Atchison?
Yes.
Chair Ringo?
Aye. And Senate Bill 887 passes, and I'll be the carrier. I want to go ahead and open up a quick work session on Senate Bill 699. I'm going to pass the gavel to Senator Atkinson for a second.
Are you in a work session or a public hearing?
These are car. Please bring forward Ralph. Welcome back to Oregon.
Saperstein
and Linda Ludwig. Is Linda in here? Can someone pull Linda back? Thanks. Welcome back to Oregon.
Thank you. Chair Atkinson, committee members. My name is Ralph Saperstein. I am the Director of Public Policy for Boise Cascade from Boise, Idaho. And that's how I got to put down more than 100 miles here. We've testified on this bill before. This bill is very important for us because Oregon is Boise Cascade's most important state. And our plants in Oregon, especially Southern Oregon, which are very high-tech and clean, they make a product called engineered wood products. And this is to replace some of the old growth that we could no longer harvest. These are manufactured beams. And it's a very clean plant. And we compete with Boise Cascade operations in other states. And this bill is important to ensure our future and to be able to operate competitively and compare hopefully favorably with our operations in other states, most notably the South.
Southern Oregon?
Louisiana, Southern United States.
Thank you.
Yes.
Sorry, Ralph. I just flew in from out there. And I'm a little jet lag. Any questions for Ralph? The Idahoan.
I still have an Oregon driver's license.
Is that legal? He still has an Oregon license.
I don't know. You know that little card that Bradbury gives us every year? It doesn't work in Idaho. So, anyway, thank you very much.
Yes.
Seeing no one else on the sign-up sheet, we'll, Linda, did you want to testify on this? She's coming forward.
Can we move this thing? Yes. Can you go ask if we can move it?
Mr. Chair, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I saw some -1 amendments in the back of the room.
There sure is.
And was wondering if the chair would be entertaining the -1 amendments. And if he does, I don't have anything to say about the bill.
Oh, I'm fine with -1s.
Could you please explain the -1s?
Sure.
I'm saving your voice. Keep it in the gavel. Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the -1 amendments simply set forth at some length the precise boundary of the territory in Jackson County that's covered by this bill. It's primarily outside of the urban growth boundary of Medford, although there is a small portion inside of the urban growth boundary of Medford.
Thank you. Linda, so -1, you're okay? Ralph? Anyone else?
That's good.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes.
You said that a small area is within the urban growth boundary and most of it is outside the urban growth boundary. Is there any different treatment for the part of it that's within the urban growth boundary?
Senator Burdick, Mr. Chairman, I do not believe under these amendments those two areas would be treated any differently.
I'm just curious as to how you could have basically one property inside the urban growth boundary. I'm confused.
I guess this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to carry over this bill to tomorrow morning so we can look at those more carefully. Mm-hmm. Apologize to the proponents of the bill, but I don't want to rush it. We need to get to the other bill. I expect to move it out at our 7 a.m. hearing tomorrow morning. I just want to look at it carefully. Okay, so let's go ahead. And again, for the record, we're going to carry over 699 until tomorrow morning. So let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 699. Let's open a public hearing on the school development charge bills, Senate Bill 307, Senate Bill 742, Senate Bill 743. We'll have the hearing on all those bills together. And let's start with Priscilla Turner and Gary Conkling. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gary Conkling, here today representing the Beaverton School District, and along with me is Priscilla Turner, who's a member of the Beaverton School Board. And we're going to do a tag team. She's going to tell you a little bit about what prompted us to work on this issue for the last decade, and then I'm going to explain some of the specific provisions in Senate Bill 742.
Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Environment and Land Use Committee, good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Priscilla Turner, and I'm the Beaverton School Board Vice Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you with information about Beaverton Schools in support of Senate Bill 742. When the Beaverton School Board adopted its legislative agenda this year, school impact fees were a high priority for us. This legislation would be very helpful to our rapidly growing district, providing us with additional financial resources to address some of our growth issues. Firstly, let me give you a snapshot of Beaverton School District. We have approximately 35,000 students, 46 schools. We are not a suburban, homogeneous, middle-class district. We are an urban, diverse, and our area is increasing in density every day. 31% of our students are minorities. 70 languages are spoken by our families. And 24% of our children are on free and reduced lunch. We relish this new diversity and our urban life, but it does add some stresses. As you may know, the Beaverton School District is one of the fastest growing districts in Oregon, with, as I mentioned, our current enrollment of 35,000 students. In the past 14 years, we have grown by over 10,000 students. We are projected to add another 758 students when our school doors open in September 2005. That equals one large elementary school, which we do not have. And the district is trending upward over the next 5 years, with over 3,100 more students expected to enroll in our schools in Beaverton by 2010. Beaverton has dealt with this rapid growth in a number of ways. First, we currently have 123 portable classrooms across the district and plan on adding many more to address the growth this coming fall. Only 8 of our schools do not have portables. Secondly, our community has been extremely generous and hardworking in their support of our schools by passing 5 capital bond measures since 1991. We have built 10 schools since 1991. We've been very busy since 1991. Our total bonded indebtedness is close to $300 million, or the equivalent of approximately $8,500 per student. Each student has $8,500 on their head of indebtedness. I wanted to just mention one school as an example, Beaver Acres Elementary. It was opened in 1927. It is a school that was picked one of six in the state for the Celebrating School Success Award from the Department of the Oregon Department of Education. It has 770 students. 64% of those are on free and reduced lunch. It has grown by five classrooms, or 125 students, in the past 2 years. Beaver Acres is not on the outskirts. Beaver Acres is in central Beaverton along the light rail. And the infill from that wonderful transportation system has added to the desirability of the area, and thus we have been affected by the growth. It currently has 14 portables. Now, I'm sure you know, these portables are trailers. They have no water, and they have no restrooms. This school has, in its core, eight bathrooms, so one for every 96 students during the day. So they're busy. The bathrooms are busy. The cafeteria is also busy. They serve lunch from 10:40 continuously through 1 p.m. And next year, they are projected to be at 150% of their current capacity. We are projecting that capacity at the elementary level will be reached by 2006, at the middle school by 2008, and at the high school, we are already over capacity and scrambling to find room. The Beaverton School Board is now considering when to ask Beaverton patrons for another capital bond to alleviate overcrowding, construct and renovate schools, purchase land, and address deferred maintenance. This legislation would give rapidly growing school districts like Beaverton the authority to impose a fee on new residential development. We strongly encourage passage of this legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming down here. Thanks for your work with Beaverton. Mr. Conkling.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Gary Conkling representing the Beaverton School District. My purpose will be just to explain Senate Bill 742 and there is continuing questions of, so what's the difference between a system development charge and a school impact fee? They fundamentally have the same goal, which is to take from new residential development essentially an equity investment that helps defray costs of new schools, school sites, or renovated or expanded school facilities. They just do it in slightly different ways. So let me explain what Senate Bill 742 does. First off, it allows a school district, after public hearings and acting by resolution, to impose a school impact fee on new residential development, single-family units as well as multifamily. A school impact fee, and this is the critical difference between it and a system development charge, is not subject to the same constraints as an SDC. For example, and maybe most important, revenues raised by a school impact fee can be used across the school district to buy land, build new schools, or expand existing schools according to needs established in the district's long-range school facility plan. The school impact fee is collected at the point of title transfer or first occupancy in the case of a developer-run multifamily residential unit. This means that cities and counties aren't involved in the collection and disbursement of fee revenue. And, maybe just as important, it also means home builders aren't required to pay the fee or carry it with interest in their construction loans. School boards under this bill would have the authority to waive or reduce the school impact fee on housing for senior citizens or for low-income housing. And developers who donate land for new schools could receive credits for all or a portion of the school impact fee due on the residential units in their development. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
The school, and thanks for the differentiating between a school impact fee and a system development charge. Would this apply, you say new residential development, anything that's built, that started after the bill passes or that's underway,
exactly what would this apply to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think that the it's a very good question to ask, and we probably need to have a more precise answer than I'm going to supply, but it would be my assumption that title transfers that would take place subsequent to the effective date of this act would be subject to this fee, if it was passed, of course, by school district. So there wouldn't be any instantaneous action because school districts would have to act first. But in the somehow imagining that it could happen very rapidly, that there could be a construction that was underway for some period of time, I think that that's how I would interpret it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
So title transfer from the developer to the first occupant or from...
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, most real estate transactions for a home are transacted with a closing with a title officer, and what's envisioned here is that this fee would be another in a series of fees or other requirements that are transacted at that point. In the case of a situation of where the person that builds a multifamily unit also is going to manage it, and this, by the way, could also occur in a few cases where someone builds their home themselves, that the fee would attach at the point of first occupancy of the facility.
In those cases, and then in other cases, I guess I'm just trying to understand how you... you know, who has to pay the fee? The first person to move into a new home?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, when a new home, and this would not be a transaction that would take place for a home that had been previously occupied, but for a new residential unit, at the point of its sale to a purchaser that would presumably be moving in, that's when most of this fee would be collected, is at that point.
And Mr. Chair, for rental housing, say that it's new rental housing, how would that be assessed?
Again, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it would be, that's the provision we've provided here when there's first occupancy. Again, there's often a title transfer for the developer to the owner, but in the event, so there would be a title transfer there too, where the same dynamic would occur, and the fee, there's a methodology for determining the fee per rental unit. But in the event that the builder or developer was also the person that was going to manage it, the fee would attach at the point of where they began renting the units.
Okay. Any other questions on this? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Schrader, are you waiting? Senator Decker, are you here on the school STC bills?
887.
Okay. Well, we passed that bill out. We'll have to talk about that. But Senator Schrader is here to testify on the school STC bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Kurt Schrader, Senate District 20. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 307 and supportive also of Senate Bill 742.
Excuse me one second. Representative Avakian, do you want to... Are you here on the school STC bills?
No, I'm here. I'm just here visiting.
Okay. Happy to have you.
It's a good crowd to visit with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have some prepared remarks here. I'm very open to questions. This is a bill that's long overdue, quite frankly. Long, long overdue. Senate Bill 307 is a very simple bill. It just adds schools to the existing Systems Development Charge statute established by the home builders in the cities, you know, back in 1989. It also has an affordable housing exemption. My thinking on this is it's just time to put schools on the same footing as any other public service. I believe it's only fair, and I think citizens understand this in a heartbeat, it's only fair that residential development pay its own way and give the taxpayer a break so they don't have to subsidize their neighbor's new home. To me, it's a fairness issue. We already have the opportunity to implement systems development charges for transportation, water, sewer, stormwater, parks. Why the heck not schools? mean, I would think many here in this audience would argue that's our most important public facility. Schools are included in the statewide enabling legislation, and states across this country, our two sister states, Washington and California, have this opportunity. They're doing a box office business in home building, just as we are. Systems development charges are not a hindrance to economic development, jobs, you name it. Well, why do we need it? Why do we need systems development charges for schools? Well, I think, again, we need them for the same reason we need these impact fees or systems development charges for the other critical public services. Residential development, in particular, does not pay its own way. Well-documented fact. Despite the hookup fees, permits, gosh, the property taxes, residential development puts a greater burden on the community's service delivery system than business does. That's why communities in my neck of the woods, Clackamas County, Happy Valley, is all excited about annexing the universe up there. They're trying to annex Clackamas Town Center, the industrial areas, because they need a business tax base to support their burgeoning residential development. I think both these bills are very clear. They're talking about residential development. We're not trying to inhibit business, industrial, commercial development. We need the tax bases. We understand that. Historically, business pays more taxes than it uses in the services, so they are excluded from this bill. Without the systems development charge for schools, our communities are literally growing broke. I think Beaverton's testimony is poignant. I think it's desperate. I think it's pathetic that they've had to come in hand on hand and glove on bended knee to try and ask and beg for support. They've led this discussion for the last 12 years. Every time they've been thwarted by the home building community. I think it's been misguided. They could be working together. Without growth paying its fair share, unless you're in a community perhaps like Beaverton, I've seen in my community, citizens are voting down bond issues. It's too expensive. Get these new people to pay their own share. With systems development charges being collected, a bill two sessions ago that was proposed, I calculated that it would have cost Canby citizens half of what it would cost them without the systems development charge to pay for their new schools. It's been very difficult. Well, geez, what's the rationale behind system development charge for schools? Well, I can tell you, I was a planning commissioner for 15 years in Canby. For every new house that came into Canby, I could count on 0.6 kids going to the school system. It's real easy. It was a simple mathematical equation. Didn't matter who actually moved in that house. Over the long haul, that new house created new capacity in the city. And that was going to cause more school children to be going to school. We had no way of paying for that. First, every school district loves having another child in the district because that's more money they get for, you know, operations, another $5,200 or whatever as we send them from the state school fund. That is, they love it until all of a sudden that school is full. And then they've got to build another school. And they've got to go back to the taxpayer and say, hey, we need more money. And they hope they get it. In some cases, they're not. Local options don't pass throughout this state. Bonds don't pass throughout this state. It's been a very difficult haul. Oh, geez, Senator Schrader, you're being mean to poor old people. What about that elderly old couple? You know, Dorothy English moves into Canby. Gosh almighty. What are you going to do for that poor lady? Well, I would argue that most of our elderly citizens are interested in having a pretty well-educated community. They'd rather not have juvenile delinquents on the street. They'd rather have a vibrant educational opportunity for their kids and their neighbors' kids, their grandkids, so that they don't have problems. I frankly would argue that if elderly couples well-heeled enough to pay for the average new house running $250,000, $300,000 in these communities around the state, Canby, Malala, not exactly huge communities or super wealthy communities, that they can easily afford the systems development charge wrapped into their mortgage over 30 years, much more so than the little old lady that's been living in that community for 30 years, living in Elmwood Park or Deerfield Estates. Both of those are manufactured home parks in my town. They're living on $800 or $900 a month. They can't afford the higher taxes to build these schools. The new people moving in, regardless of age, should help pay. I would also argue, quite frankly, that good schools mean good communities, mean good resale value. So people that are moving in, even if they don't have children, it's to their advantage. Another myth I'd like to dispel briefly is that school impact fees are going to increase the price of housing. It's just unconscionable, Senator Schrader. I mean, gosh, housing's so darn expensive already. Well, yeah, housing's expensive, but it's not as a result of the fees that are being charged. Any 10th grade economics student knows that the price of the house is driven by supply and demand. It has absolutely nothing to do with what it costs. I could spend a lot of money in my veterinary business or any business trying to put a product together, and regardless of how much it costs me, if I don't offer a competitive price, they're not going to buy it. So it has to do with supply and demand. Why the fees for new homes these days are still constituting less than 5% of the cost of a new house. That has not changed before or after systems development charges. The cost drivers nowadays are the price of land. That's gone up. The other big thing that's never talked about is the size of the homes. Great article in the Oregonian the other day. It's the size of the homes that are huge compared. They're almost twice as large now as they were 25, 30 years ago. That's driving up the price of the homes. It is not the small fees that are being collected by the poor communities that are trying not to grow broke. I actually had a developer in Canby about 4 years ago apologize in our local paper for charging as much as he did for the homes he was building. But he said, hey, people are willing to pay it. And that's free enterprise. I respect that. There's nothing wrong with that. He had nothing to apologize for, but had nothing to do with the cost he was incurring. I would also point out that in this bill, if you're an elderly person or trying to get by, that we have an affordable housing exemption here. We exempt housing for people that are trying to move in at 80% of the median income. Three final points, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One is that this is merely permissive enabling legislation. There's no mandate. No one has to do anything. This just allows local school districts and communities the opportunity to have assistance development charge if they think it works for them. There's some communities that aren't growing. They're not going to go there. There's some communities that philosophically don't agree with this approach. They don't have to do it. But let's not take away a vibrant tool for those that want to and need to and feel it's an important part of their community. I had people from Hood River visit me that indicated that some of the developers up there were actually in favor of this legislation. The other thing I point out is it's dedicated to school construction only. This is pretty nice. I mean, if one of the few times a citizen of the state knows that when they pay a fee, it's going to go only for that purpose. It can only go for school construction. That's pretty nice. You know that when you're moving into that community, you're helping build a vibrant, long-standing community that's going to grow and develop healthily, supporting the children and the grandchildren in that community. It also frees up money, operational money, for school support. That means we have to put, as a co-chair of Ways and Means, have to put a little less of our state income tax dollars into state school fund. Lastly, I drive home the point that it's the home building industry that brought this statute to us in the first place. Back in 1989, when they thought they were being treated unfairly, when Lake Oswego was charging them $400. $400! My gosh! You know, for parks improvement offsite. I mean, that is outrageous. Get what you ask for, and we now have a very detailed methodology that protects the development community, protects the existing community for capital construction. It has to be worked out before any of these fees can be assessed. I think it's about fairness. They wanted fairness in 1989. I think we're looking as parents and students and stewards of this great state, we're looking for fairness here in 2005. I just think it's important to make our most important public facility a part of our future, like it is in Washington and California. Let's vote for schools and lower taxes and pass Senate Bill 307. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Schroeder. I just want to emphasize one of your points. I think it's a matter of local control. I mean, if people in the east side of the state or somewhere else, if they don't want school impact fees, they don't have to have them. But for certain communities like mine, and I think yours and others, it's a crucial planning tool. And by not giving communities that tool, we're harming children in those communities.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate your bringing this bill forward. Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Schroeder. I was with you right up until the point you talked about reducing the money in the state school fund. But seriously, I want to thank you for your
sure.
ongoing efforts in this area. You've been unflagging in your efforts, and it really is about fairness and people paying their way for services that benefit everyone. So.
Thank you. thank you. It seems to be spreading. The North Clackamas School District is really concerned about this. I've been visited by Redmond, Hood River. It's no longer a valley issue. It's starting to spread throughout this state. Other communities are growing, which is great. Let's have them hopefully grow healthily. And
a new part of my district is Tigard, and that's a growing area as well.
That's true.
And again, I was at a forum last night where this came up, and the concern about affordable housing came up, and I want to commend you for addressing that proactively.
Thank you very much, Senator Burdick. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
I appreciate you coming here. Let's have Rayanne Jackson, Pam Callahan. These are the folks that send me emails every week saying, "You're my senator. I hope you're working on this." Findlay Elementary School. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you, Chairman Ringo, members of the committee. My name is Rayanne Jackson, and I have with me Pam Callahan, and due to the time constraints, I'm going to speak for the two of us. Thank you for allowing me to speak today before you regarding the SDCs and our experience without them. We are members of the Findlay Elementary School's Local School Committee, which is located in the northern part of the Beaverton School District. I currently have a daughter who is in first grade at Findlay, and a son who is in the sixth grade and attending Stoller Middle School, also located in Beaverton. Findlay Elementary School opened in September of 1997. Our school opened at capacity of an enrollment of 600 students. By September of 1999, Findlay Elementary School was looking at an enrollment of over 900 students. Findlay at that time was holding all kindergarten classes at an off-site location where there were multiple portable classrooms which accommodated this portion of our school. At Findlay itself, we were accommodating over 700 students on site at the school that was built to only accommodate 550 students. The school district had already positioned two double-wide portables on site, and we were holding a classroom in the faculty lunchroom and a class on our stage. We were quite obviously bursting at the seams. In September of 1998, the Beaverton School District rushed to get a bond levy put on the ballot, which would fund a new school to be built and land to be acquired for that school. By a very slim margin, that bond was passed and Jacob Wismer was built and occupied by September of 2000, at which case over half of Findlay's enrollment was transferred to Jacob Wismer. Currently, 4.5 years later, Findlay Elementary School is sitting with an enrollment of 685 students, and Jacob Wismer has an enrollment of over 740 students. We at Findlay are currently looking at 700 new homes that will be built within the next year, all within Findlay's boundaries. This will potentially push Findlay's enrollment to over 1,000 children. Although the district's goal is to keep class sizes fairly adequate, we would have nowhere to put any additional teachers. Hence, the number of students in each class would increase greatly. We would also be looking at starting school lunches at 10:20 a.m., which would be exactly 2 hours after school has started and would leave some children with another four, almost 5 hours left of the school day to get through without any additional nutrition. The Beaverton School District currently does not have the land or money to accommodate any new construction of schools at this time. Therefore, we are looking at an overcapacity issue within both Findlay and Jacob Wismer. Unfortunately, this is not only a Findlay-Jacob Wismer issue. On January 19, 2005, the Beaverton School District had an all-day work session, which we, as Findlay's local school committee, attended. We were given very disturbing news for the upcoming school year of September 2005. The school district is forecasting that of the 31 elementary schools within the Beaverton School District, 17 of those elementary schools will be over 100% of their capacity numbers. Of the 8 middle schools Beaverton School District has, 6 of those will be over 100% capacity. And of the 5 high schools, 4 of those will start next September with over 100% capacity. The school district currently has 169 portable classrooms on site. With the lack of funds and property to build on, the Beaverton School District feels their only option at this point in time is to site more portables and expand existing facilities. If we do not have available educational space for the number of students we currently have, then where will we be putting any additional students when and if new businesses contemplate bringing their employees and their families to Oregon? At what point will Oregon begin to lose its marketability with overcrowded and inadequate classrooms? If the Oregon public school system is not strong, this will greatly impact the marketability of new businesses choosing Oregon as a livable state for their employees. We believe that Oregonians value education and are willing to contribute to its infrastructure. If people are willing to buy new homes within Oregon, then they should be willing to contribute to the infrastructure. We are asking you to please allow this very important bill, number 307, to go forward with your endorsement.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The numbers are compelling.
They're scary.
Yes, they are. Our kids will go to Elmonica. And Elmonica is not on the growth fringe, but it's having a lot of infill. Mm-hmm. And that infill is really leading to the same problem.
Yes.
Go ahead. Ms. Callahan?
Yeah, I didn't have a lot of additional comments. But primarily, I guess my comment would be, most people, the vast majority, think that we are, when we buy our homes, we think we are contributing to the infrastructures of schools and are shocked to find out that we haven't.
Okay.
And we have a lot of people, like you said, coming from Washington and California, so that is the assumption.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, John Chandler, are you still in the room? Why don't you come up? That'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in opposition to all three bills, which I don't imagine comes as any surprise. Senator Schrader probably gave my organization far more credit than it deserves and on this issue. But it's no secret that we believe that impact fees or SDCs are a bad idea for schools. What is, I think, oftentimes not understood is that we understand it's a problem. We understand the problem facing Beaverton. We understand the problem facing Bend. And I want to spend a little time, if you don't mind, talking about some other conversations that have happened concerning this issue over the years. Back probably 10, 12 years ago, we worked with the Beaverton District and others to put schools in the land use planning process. They were not part of it. Cities did planning. Counties did planning. Excuse me. Schools weren't considered. What happened was a lot of subdividing, a lot of development, no contact with the schools, oftentimes fistfights between the jurisdictions, the school district, the cities. We helped put that in the statute that local governments and schools should work together, should plan together. There are recently stories in the Oregonian involving Happy Valley, I think it was, or the North Clackamas School District, in which, had that process been followed, a lot of the discontent and a lot of the angst could have been avoided. To get schools in at the planning stage when the community is looking at where the subdivision should go makes a lot of sense. We've also worked with the school districts over the years. Every local home builders association in the state has been supportive of bond measures, has contributed money, people, campaign help. We've worked with the school districts on trying to make it possible to get schools outside of urban growth boundaries so the land could be acquired cheaper. We've worked many years ago on trying to set up a school capital fund within the state school funds. There's a small one there. We were involved in that effort to create it. We thought it should have been much larger. Back when Lynn Lundquist was Speaker of the House, we helped unsuccessfully try to set up a rainy day fund for school construction and for school operations. Last session, Senator Schrader and I worked very hard trying to engineer a process by which local governments would be paid back for parks fees out of the lottery fund. The money currently that we were paying for parks system development charges could be transferred to a school fund. That fell apart. You know, nobody's lack of effort. It simply proved impossible to do. We have another bill this session I want to spend a little time on here in a moment. My point, Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, we know there's a problem. What we don't agree on with folks in this room is that the SDC or an impact fee is the proper way to fix it. In my written testimony, you'll see some little factoids and arguments. One of the ones I want to call to your attention is that Oregon's home ownership rate is 44th in the country. We never have had a particularly good home ownership rate. It's dropping. Any increase in the cost of housing, and I disagree with Senator Schrader on that, he and I disagreed on this issue over the years, any increase in fee, school, park, road, doesn't matter, increases the cost. Every dollar increase in the price of housing means you have to make about $2.50 in income to qualify. higher the price, fewer people can buy. I think homeownership is important. I think everybody here would agree to that. We don't want to see anything detract from that. SDCs generally are bad tax policy, whether for schools or anything else. They're inefficient. You can almost, I think, chart back in the Nixon years when federal revenue sharing declined, local government started looking to other forms of revenue. I understand why they needed the money. Our property tax measures in this state have effectively cut the throat of local government, especially schools. I understand that as well. But impact fees cost, to get the government, let's say, a $5,000 impact fee, is going to cost the person buying the home somewhere between $15,000 and $18,000, depending on what kind of interest rate you assume for the mortgage. There's no other tax that we impose that has that level of inefficiency. At the end of the day, the local government doesn't get $18,000 or $15,000. They get the $5,000 they started with. Collectively, we ought to be smarter than having a system that has that kind of a penalty. One piece of kind of political science that I think is important and gets lost in this discussion. Back in the olden days, when somebody's barn burned down, we all pitched in and rebuilt the barn. Everybody in this room drove here on a road that somebody else paid for. Everybody in this room went to school in a school building somebody else paid for. Now, over the years, and I understand why we've done this, we've moved away from a humanitarian sort of viewpoint to one where if I need a school, I better help build it. If I need a sewer system, I better help pay for it. Sooner or later, it's going to be if I need an ambulance, I better help pay for it. I don't think that's good for our communities, because what we're doing, when we're focusing on housing as one piece, and I was intrigued to hear the woman from Beaverton a moment ago talking about the impact of light rail. Houses ain't on light rail. They didn't come there on light rail. Housing does not drive jobs. Jobs drive housing. I'm not proposing a jobs tax. That'd be silly. Oregon's economy is still coming out of a recession. But the point is, people oftentimes misconstrue the impact of housing or the role of housing in our economy. And I think to focus simply on housing, because it's easy, it's visible, if you see subdivisions marching up a hillside, you understand that more people are moving there. As in my written testimony, I pointed out, we've done surveys on this, and it's been pretty consistent. About 60% of the people who buy a new house, a new construction, already live in the taxing district, the school district in which they're buying. So a school impact fee, or school SDC, simply taxes people for moving down the street. Not like water and sewer, where something had to be extended, something had to be run. I don't think anybody in this room's mind is going to get changed by my testimony today. I'd be delighted. I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't. There is a problem, Mr. Chairman. We have a bill in the House, House Bill 2964, in the House Revenue Committee, that would capture part of the increment value on new construction, dedicate that to schools. We brought that bill forward twice before, both times before with the Beaverton School District, Mr. Conkling's assistance. I understand the arguments against that bill, in that it only reshuffles existing money. It doesn't bring any new money into the system. Everything this building does, though, is reshuffling existing money. There is no new money coming in, absent an idea like this that I think has bad policy implications, aside from the financial impact. House Bill 964 could be an answer to this problem. We've also been having conversations with a couple of school groups about the possibility of going after ballot measure 5. Because I believe that the decline in Oregon's livability, the start of our fiscal crisis at the state level, started when we decided that people in local communities ought not have the right to tax themselves if they so choose. I thought that was a silly policy then. I think it's a silly policy now. I'm not sure why on earth it's my business if the folks in Canby or Beaverton or someplace else where I do not live choose to tax themselves. Now, ballot measure 5 says you can't. Maybe we ought to take a stab at that. I hope to work with the schools on that issue. I've gotten my industry ready to take a stab to that, to say that new construction ought to help pay more for schools, for roads. But doing it through the property tax has a much less of an impact on housing affordability. It has a much less impact on other issues I've mentioned in terms of the community and other things. And in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, if these bills move, we'll be in opposition. Our opposition to these ideas doesn't mean that we are blind to the fact that a Beaverton, a Bend, is growing quickly, is penalized by our tax system. City of Beaverton gets to keep the money on new construction by their property tax. Beaverton School District does not. That's bad policy. We'd like to help change that. Our House Bill 2964 would make some corrective measures. Going to the ballot, asking the people to change Measure 5 would have even more effect. Be glad to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you very much. Just a couple. My understanding is that school system development charges are in place in our neighboring states of Washington and California. Home builders do just fine in those states, don't they? I mean, they're not really harmed by the existence of those
impact fees.
Mr. Chairman, they're dropping like flies by the side of the There was a story on that on CNN days ago.
All right.
No, and that's absolutely true, Mr. Chairman. They also pump their own gas in both those states, and they have different lotteries. It's apples and giraffes. It really is. The fact that there's an impact fee for schools, they don't have our land use system.
That's right.
They don't have a lot of the things we do. It's a package. And one of my problems, to just continue on answering it, I've done a survey of other states around the country that impose various fees for various things. California also has impact fees for daycare centers in some communities. I mean, I want to go back to my Major 5 comment. There's a listserv of people that do what I do for homebuilders around the country. Some guy in Oklahoma posted a question, should the homebuilders in Oklahoma get behind a property tax limitation? And the guy, my counterpart in California, and I both wrote a response within about 10 minutes of each other, didn't see each other's responses, and we both said, for heaven's sakes, no. Because I think you can track the rise of impact fees in California, which in some cases are over $100,000 a house, to the decline of revenue at the local level through property taxes. In my mind, the fact that, yes, they do have school impact fees, that doesn't mean we ought to.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay.
Thank you
very much.
It's compelling. I changed my mind.
Yeah. You talked him into it, John. Thank you. Let's hear for the folks from us Stanford Children. Pauline McGuire, Bob Brusky, Nathan Kadish, please. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Senator Ringo, committee members. I know I'll try not to take too long. I just actually have a one-pager. I'll make it quick, but then I'd really like to make two comments at the end, if I may. My name is Pauline McGuire. I am a member of Stanford Children, a resident of Clackamas County, and I have a son in first grade at Oregon Trail Elementary in the North Clackamas School District. I am here today to address Bill 307 on adding schools to the current list of system development charges. I would like to ask all of you, if you were developing a community, what would that include? Streets, traffic lights, sewers, storm drains, homes, parks, what about schools? I find it hard to believe this community wouldn't include schools. Currently, fees are paid on all these services except for schools. Schools are not considered on a state level, not considered as part of critical infrastructure or a critical service. How can this be? How can we say that roads and sewers are more important part of a community than our kids? But in reality, we are. Oregon Trail Elementary, where my son attends, is currently over capacity by almost 200 kids. Yet everywhere you drive around this area, homes are being built. These homes are being built at a faster rate than the school district can keep up with, but there is currently no tool in place for the school district to use to help with the growing capacity these developments create on enrollment. This makes no sense to me. How can the state not recognize this? In both neighboring states to the north and south of us, this exact issue has been addressed. Schools are considered on a state level, and this is a huge help for the school district to be able to receive funds for new schools or capital improvements. This lessens the amount the district has to go out for bond and helps share the responsibility in the community instead of it being only on the taxpayer. In the last 5 years, almost 3,000 homes were approved by Clackamas County. These housing units produced approximately 1,900 students to our schools. Developers were required to pay fees for the impact caused on the road, sewer, and water, but not on the impact created on the school from these developments. Yet some of these same developers are paying the fees in the schools and other states they build in. How can we let this happen? In talking to a lot of your constituents over the past year on this exact issue, They either say two things. They either think developers already pay something for schools because it is so logical, or they think this should happen. Times have changed. It is not so much the little builder anymore. It is the large development corporations building numerous homes at a time. Schools cannot keep up with this. People are choosing to live in these homes partly for the school district, so it only makes sense that developers and schools go hand in hand. We cannot have a strong, healthy community without this, so let's be responsible and do the right thing. Make schools the priority they are and give the proper tool to do this.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Can I just make two comments?
No, of course you can.
It's just so frustrating because I think what we are talking about really is a fairness issue here. And it is just so difficult to listen to something being put onto somebody else. I mean, I think that, not to pick on the Home Builders Association, but is all I could understand from that conversation was that the responsibility is wanting to be put every place else except there. And so I just want to make this clear that it is so important for school districts to be able to have a tool. And in Oregon, as we are always an area that wants to grow and find a new, better place to live. And so when a community is small, that might be the way in Joseph, Oregon right now. But if 15 years from now people want to have that be the next explosion, it'll be just like Bend. And we cannot have that happen throughout the entire state as time goes on. Thank you.
No, you make a good point. I've heard people say they oppose school SDCs, but they think that the better solution is fixing Measure 5. So we're fine, get us there. Or maybe it's a real estate transfer tax. That's the better way. Fine, get us there. But the opponents of school SDCs have no politically feasible way of solving the problems that are really harming our children. So I appreciate that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to thank the chairman and this committee for having this hearing today. My name is Bob Bresky, and I'm a resident and teacher in Clackamas County Public Schools. Developers who build homes now have to contribute to basic infrastructure, roads, water, sewer, and parks. Why shouldn't they also be charged for the added burden that they bring to the local school districts? Let's go through the arguments briefly. Growth brings increases in school enrollment. The numbers don't hide the truth, which we've heard here today from Beaverton and Sherwood, we all hear about. In 2004, 17 Oregon school districts registered double-digit percentage gains in student enrollment. These increases affected both rural and urban areas and occurred in both eastern and western portions of the state. These increases range from 10% in Umatilla and Bethel districts to 38% in Riverdale. Some say the residential growth does not necessarily increase school populations because not all homeowners have children in public schools. So do all homeowners use parks? The fact is that even if the homeowners don't have school-age children or send their kids to private schools, they benefit from the increased value that good schools bring to a community. Skeptics say that system development charges for schools will raise the price of houses beyond affordability. The facts don't bear that out. Currently, developers in places like West Lynn pay $23,000 or $25,000 in system development charges, yet houses are sold in less than a week and demand is still high. This is one of the highest levels of SDCs in the state, and still the housing market is strong. Turns out that really developers just don't want to pay more in the state. But why only in Oregon? Some states are doing something about this problem. For example, home prices in Washington and California reflect school impact fees levied on the homes they buy. Attached to my testimony today is a list of the SDCs being charged in Washington state counties to support schools. The SDCs average about $2,000 per house. Adding $2,000 to the average purchase price of an Oregon home raises that price by an average of 1%, assuming the developer passes on these costs to the buyer. Thus, the financial impact on consumers and builders in the state would be negligible, considering that most new home construction in Oregon is being now financed by large national developers like D.R. Horton, who willingly pay SDCs for schools in other states. The state of Florida has gone even a step further to ensure that developers mitigate their impact on schools. For example, in Palm Beach County, developers there must pay for the construction of new schools when school enrollments soar as a result of new housing developments. These states recognize that mitigating gross impacts upon public services is everyone's responsibility, including developers. We don't believe that STCs for schools have to pay for the entire new school project, land, building, and all. Rather, we simply want developers to contribute enough to mitigate the impact their developments have upon schools. We think Senate Bill 307 is a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair and Senator Beyer, I don't have anything to add other than what these well-versed Stanford Children members previously stated, other than to delve a little more into the issue of cost that Senator Schrader brought up. In fact, SDCs do not increase the cost of housing. I as Senator Schrader referred to, revert back to my 10th grade economics class and do remember that supply and demand dictates that we certainly will not pay more than the market will bear for a home. I, being a first-time homeowner, did not pay more for the home simply because there were system development charges attached. I paid what the market rode. When we think about that, I would like to also discuss briefly the trend in Oregon of large home builders coming in. As Ms. McGuire suggested, we are not in the days as we were before of the small home builders. We have builders such as D.R. Horton coming in, and in my written testimony you'll see that on D.R. Horton's website they post that they had a 56% increase in their annual net income in 2004, securing over $10 billion in revenue, which is a 23% increase in their profit margin, and they anticipate another $12 billion in revenue this year. So if they're paying hundreds of millions of dollars in SDCs and impact fees for schools in our neighboring states, they're clearly investing in the infrastructure in which in the states in which they build, yet they come to Oregon, build their homes, and leave with 100% of the profits without leaving anything like a school building in our communities to show that they've built and profited here, leaving something for the residents of Oregon and our children for generations to come. I thank you for your time today.
Could you testify? Thank you. Is there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm looking for a sign-up list. Let me see. Thank you very much. Pat Everson Brady and Ann Saxby.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Atkinson and members of the committee. My name is Ann Saxby. I'm from Hood River, Oregon. I am the I'm accompanied by Pat Evenson Brady. She is the Superintendent of Schools for Hood River County School District, and I am the current chair of the school board. I'd like to apologize for taking so long to bring our dog into this fight. You know, these poor folks out here in the valley have been coming year after year to the legislature trying to get some kind of mechanism in place to fund the outrageous increases in their school enrollment and their need for schools. We've been lucky enough to have 1 or 2% growth every year, but now that's kind of multiplying on us, and 1 and 2%, you know, 5 or 10 years ago might have been 50 kids, and then all of a sudden it's 150 kids. At this point, we have our high school is over capacity, our two middle schools are over capacity, and 3 of our 5 elementary schools are over capacity. We've been averaging about 100 new units a year coming into our area, and with the passage of Measure 37, we are looking at having 1,000 units. The first application in the door for Hood River County was for 1,000 units in a county of 20,000 people. We have to get something in place or we will have lost it. It is no longer an issue of the Portland suburbs. It is an issue throughout the state. Measure 37 has changed the whole nature of the argument. We have got to have something in place throughout the state that allows our local communities to levy system development charges for schools. The communities that don't need it won't be coming to their, you know, their city councils, but we have. We've already come to our county commission, our city council. Cascade Lock City Council has already passed a resolution in support of issuing system development charges for schools. This is not a community you think of in the same way you think of Beaverton or you think of Lake Oswego. I mean, Cascade Locks is not a wealthy community, but they are a community that can see that their future might mean some growth, and they want to make sure that they have an adequate school facility for that growth. Oh, I forgot to pass the pieces around. Sorry about that.
anyhow, I won't reiterate the other comments, but I would urge you, I have many ideas about how we might reconfigure Measure 5 and go back and do a bunch of other things, but at this day and age, I would agree with Senator Ringo, those are not things that are going to be happening anytime soon, and this is something that we can put into place. The communities that need it can, it can allow for system development charges, and we can see our new development pay for the facilities that they, that those residents will be needing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Ringo, Chairman Ringo, and members of the committee, I am the superintendent of the Hood River County School District, and our board has passed a resolution in support of gaining systems development charges for construction. Ann's given you some numbers. The one that scares me is 550 single-family homes on permit currently in the urban growth boundary in Hood River. And again, that's a, in a county of 20,000. We have currently used up our ability to tax folks through the property tax. We have a permanent rate. We have a local option. We have two existing bond issues. In a county with an unemployment rate that hovers regularly right around 10%, the growth, the economic boom that happened in the state did not happen in Hood River County. So it's important that if we want to continue to sustain any sort of economic growth, we have to have adequate schools for our children. The systems development charges would not, by themselves, provide us with enough money to build schools. What they would provide us with is political capital to say to our old-time residents, the newcomers are paying a share of the cost for those new schools that they have created the need for. In our district, 7 of our 15 buildings were built before World War II. We make good use of our buildings, we take good care of our facilities, and we run good school systems. But we need some help in coping with growth, and Ann said it well, it needs to be a statewide issue. I appreciate the chance to speak to you on this issue and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
I really appreciate your testimony. All those housing starts you're talking about doesn't include potential Measure 37 issues.
No, no, it does not.
No. There's some very significant developments.
But that's inside the urban growth boundary.
That's right. Yeah.
So that doesn't even touch the Measure 37 claims. And as Ann pointed out, the first Measure 37 claim in Hood River County was for 1,000 units in a county of 20,000 folks.
Senator Shields?
I appreciate the way you started your testimony when you said that you apologize for being late and bringing your dog to this fight. I thought that was kind of interesting. Right. When it doesn't affect us, we don't get into the fight. Now all of a sudden you're confronting this. How many more towns do you think around Oregon might kind of heed this call?
I think there's a lot of towns that have a dog in this fight now. I mean, and a lot of ones that are probably out of the range of your, you know, purview. I mean, Hermiston certainly is having huge amounts of growth out there. And in terms of the Measure 37, you may well see Joseph and Enterprise. You know, you may see ones you've never even thought of, but you'll have, you know, they have an attraction for folks, and you may see all sorts of new folks coming to the fray.
Chairman Ringo and Senator Shields, we're told that about a third of the school districts in Oregon are experiencing growth. The other two-thirds are not. So in terms of who's potentially a dog in the fight, that would be the number that I think might be interested.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you guys are right on target. Brad Schock, sorry to keep you waiting. And Don Bonder, you're not on the list. I don't know. Okay. And David Williams and Rob Saxton, please. Your name was in very small letters, so I didn't.
I know. I had to sneak it in there.
That's okay.
Senator Ringo and the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity. My name is Brad Schock, and I'm a parent in the Beaverton School District. I have three children currently in elementary, middle, and high school. I'm also a product of the Oregon system. I have some prepared remarks here, but I listened to the gentleman from the Home Developers Association, and I'm just stunned. You know, I would think that we would be here preaching to the choir when we're talking to the entire legislature about this. He mentioned things that the Home Builders Association had tried to do in the past to help the situation. Well, that was 20 years ago. This is now. The problem is here. It's today. It's not what happened 20 years ago. You know, we can look at Measure 5 as being a solution for some of the things that we try to do, but quite frankly, Measure 5 is not a facilities funding mechanism. It's an operational funding mechanism. And we need to keep focused on what the issues are. And the issue is there's a lot of houses being built. You know, the majority of my K through 12 education was in Bend, Oregon during the 1970s. And during that time, we experienced huge growth, tremendous growth. It was growth that nobody anticipated, just like right now. Then as now, capital expenditure for schools, school facilities was based entirely on passing local bond measures. I clearly remember my mother at one time commenting on how she was hoping yet another attempt to pass a bond levy to finance schools was not going to be publicized. Because the thought was that if those who knew the importance of its passing were aware of the election, it would pass. It failed. Ultimately, it wasn't until Bend High School implemented double shifting during my tenure there that the Bend community woke up and passed a bond measure allowing the building of Mountain View High School. That was 30 years ago. We're looking at the same problems today. When are we going to fix them? I feel like I'm in a time machine. In our neighborhood, the elementary school, Finley, which you've heard quite a bit about today, we're at overcapacity. The middle school, Stoller, is at capacity. The high school, Sunset, is at overcapacity. In a recent meeting in which the demographer for the Beaverton School District was present, it was indicated that in our neighborhood alone, they expect around a 10% increase in student numbers for the 2005-2006 school year. My experience with the Beaverton School District demographic formula is that it historically is underestimated by a significant amount. And I think we've already heard testimony today as to how that happened, because 5 years ago we were at 900 kids. And that was before they built the neighborhood directly across the street, directly behind, and directly across the street, adding about 500 to 700 more homes. The district representatives also felt that pushing through a bond measure to deal with capacity issues is not realistic until the national election in 2006 due to the double majority rule. What this translates into is that there can be no new capacity online until the 2007-2008 school year. Hey, by then it's going to be too late. Land will have already been saturated with dwellings filled with families who need schools. But there won't be any schools for them. They'll just be overcrowded buildings, and the drastic measures such as double shifting will have to be implemented. On one hand, we're very, very lucky in our neighborhood that we currently have good schools. But on the other hand, these same good schools draw more families into our community, which is a reason for the explosive growth in new housing developments. And I go back to what the gentleman from representing the housing development group said, that most people who are moving into new housing are moving in from their same neighborhood. They're not adding. My development 8 years ago was a cow pasture, surrounded by cow pastures. There was nobody living in our neighborhood now who moved in from our community. Everyone moved in from the outside. Anyway, what this translates, what I want to say is that we're lucky, and simple economics shows that the number of families wanting to live in our area is inflating home prices at a rate that far outpaces the cost of building a home. So when we're discussing the issues with regards to home prices being unaffordable, the bottom line is the result is a home developer's profits are increasing based on the desirability of the area, and they're increasing tremendously. And proof of this is in their financial statements that you can find in any annual report of a publicly held home developer.
And if you could just wrap it up.
You bet.
Please.
Bottom line is it's good policy for the developers whose profits are increased as a function of the academic desirability of the neighborhood to contribute significantly to the school system that helps them increase their revenues. Considering any SDC fee collected is a pass-through to the ultimate consumer, it's time for the developers to be part of the solution instead of the problem. If the goal is for the children of Oregon to be educated at globally competitive level, we must have the facilities to achieve this objective. Current funding practices make this nearly prohibitive. Enabling communities who need it to enact an SDC for school funding for funding school facilities is the responsible solution. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. You hit the nail on the head. Go ahead, Mr. Williams.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams, Oregon School Boards Association. Don't really have much to add to a lot of the testimony you've heard. OSBA just wants to lend its support to all three of these bills. We think that this is another important tool that districts could have in combating the problems facing high-growth districts. It's important to note that our association passed a resolution a number of years ago supporting adding schools to the SDC statutes, and of course that resolution was passed by our entire association, not just sort of a high-growth caucus, if you will. All of our districts understand the value of SDCs, whether they are facing high-growth issues or not. They very well could be the next one, as some of your testimony was received earlier. But just to support all three of these bills, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Saxton.
Chairman Ringo, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to you today. I'm Rob Saxton, superintendent of the Sherwood School District. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 307. I would tell you that this is an issue that Sherwood faces along with many other communities across the state, I think, as you've heard today. Just a little bit about the Sherwood School District in our community. Our school district has grown rapidly over the past 15 years, 3,000 people in our community in 1990, 15,000 people in 2005. Pretty amazing growth as a percentage. Our school district was 1,350 students in 1990 and were 3,795 in 2005. We're the fastest growing school district in the state with 26% growth over the last 5 years. We grew 6.2% between last fall and this. The Sherwood School District is projected to continue rapid growth into the foreseeable future. Demographic projections indicate growth of 25.8% over the next 5 years. Our district long-range facility planning committee extrapolates continued growth over the next 20 years, growth from 3596 this year to 8756, a growth of 5,160 students in the next 20 years. Pretty incredible growth. Sherwood housing submissions reached an all-time high in 2004 of over 525 units. If you look at metro exception land within the Sherwood School District, there's a greater land mass within the Sherwood School District than the total of all other districts combined on the west side of I-5. Simply put, Sherwood's grown fast, is growing fast, and will continue to grow quickly. Sherwood facility needs create a significant hardship on district patrons and the school district. All of our schools will be over capacity next year. The district long-range facility planning committee projects costs for schools needed by 2008, election 2006, at a minimum of $72 million. When you consider that in Sherwood, with our assessed value, 31 cents per thousand generates $10 million in revenue for the district for a bond. Furthermore, by 2015, we would need to pass another bond for a high school and two additional elementary schools in the neighborhood of $82 million for a combination of $153,600,000 in the next 8 years. That would give our, at 31 cents a thousand, that would give us $6.03 per thousand just for bricks and mortar, not including anything else. Other issues complicate fiscal management for high-growth districts. I want you to know that people tell us all the time that they move to our community specifically because we have excellent schools in Sherwood. High-growth communities typically pay on other bonds besides just schools. In Sherwood, our local taxpayers pay for a new police station, new city hall, city library, city-owned YMCA, and more. And therefore, the total amount of bonded indebtedness in a community like Sherwood is truly significant. There's no other factor in state school funding formula for high-growth districts, only for districts that have declining enrollment. High-growth districts have additional expenses in textbooks, staff, portable buildings, furniture, materials, and supplies. We're adding 18 portables this year at the cost of approximately $1 million. And we have no dollars that we're generating in order to pay for that. And so it comes at the expense of operating expenses. High-growth districts are severely hampered in passing a local option in support of bonds at the same time. And I haven't heard anybody address that today, but when our taxpayers are at $6.02 a thousand so that we can pay for bricks and mortar, it's pretty tough for us to go back out and say we'd like $1 a thousand so we can generate $1.2 million in operating funds for a year, and let's just have that tax rate be at 702 instead of 602. And that is a big issue for us. Our district, as I said, has grown and will continue to grow. With no SDCs, our level of bonded indebtedness will grow to a level that is not sustainable. School districts districts have no control over growth, we can only respond. And school districts are penalized for growth in the funding formula by additional expenses and by the challenge of passing a local option tax in addition to needed bonds. SDCs make sense in high-growth districts like Sherwood, and it's my understanding that this bill would allow for local control over SDCs, and we think that it's a bill that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Atkinson?
I just want to thank you all for coming, and I really appreciate your comments from Beaverton.
Thank you.
And I also want to tell the audience, there's many people here who've come, and there's a few left that are always in the building, and I just want to let you know my office is open. I've been here for 12 hours. I was up all night, and I haven't seen my son in 9 days. So I'm going to, we're usually done at 5. I'm going to excuse myself. But those of you that are always in the building, please come back and find me anytime. My door's always open. Thank you.
Go home and see your son.
All right.
Thank you very much. My only comment, Mr. Saxton, is I don't know where you live, but work on your elected officials.
We certainly do. Thank you. Always.
Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Shock. I really appreciate that. Sharon Canopa, Bill, is it Smaldeen? Richard Reed? Just to the audience, we have about 3 more people after this panel.
And another committee waiting.
Another committee to go to next. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Senator, for allowing me to be able to speak, and both senators, what's left here, I guess, of the committee. So my name is Sharon Canopa, and I'm an Albany City Councilor. In respect to the limited time, I'm not going to read my whole letter since it would take a while to read it. There was a few things that were stated that I would like to bring out, though, and also I'd like to concur with Senator Schrader's. Everything he stated was absolutely perfectly, you know, so he really spelled it out. So, but I did notice, I think Mr. Chandler had also mentioned about the growth from a couple of the larger cities, including Ben, but in Albany, for only a population of 44,000, we have had significant amount of growth, and we've had 400 to 500 new homes built the past, you know, 5 years. Our school district is going out, hopefully, in 06 for a school bond, and I wish they would have been here to be able to speak on this bill. It's very politically lobbied in our community, but they are talking. The talk is of having $5 per thousand for a bond to go out. We also have D.R. Horton building a 200-home subdivision in Albany, which he did also cut out 228 trees for that development. So we are being affected by out-of-state corporations coming in here, taking those corporate dollars and profits out of our state. So there's a couple points that I haven't heard today. So one I'd like to say, most young working families' income rises over time, but every retired and low-income citizen does not have that ability. They can barely afford the increases from the rising cost of living. My area I represent is a very low-income area. Why should low-income residents be subsidizing new development? Is that fair and equitable? Every dollar that is tapped onto every resident from fees supporting new development is one less dollar spent in our community. When all residents subsidize new development, most of those dollars go out of our community and out of our state. By keeping costs down for all residents, their dollars stay in our community, which supports our economic base. Of your 3 school SDCs bills that you have on the plate, I really feel Senate Bill 307 is the most workable. I don't think putting a cap on school SDCs is going to end up bringing up enough revenue. For the larger cities, it could bring in the revenue, but not the smaller cities. So what I would say, what I could see happening is you're going to have communities only building a modular building for their children and to be able to give them a good quality education. So I don't think capping that $3,000 is fair. They need to be able to go what their long-term needs are. They base it for their facility plan and what it takes for the build-out of their community, and then they'll end up dividing that up by how much they project their population growth. Yeah. That's what the fair way to base the SDC on. So,
just a couple more minutes, please.
Okay, actually, and I will just go ahead and wrap it up. I want to, you know, commend you for bringing this bill forward. It's long overdue. The legislature has got to do something because they're not giving communities another solution, and Albany needs help. This is not the only for facilities we need to expand on, and we also need it for police, fire, and libraries, also in desperate need. Our voters had said rejected for a library bond last November, so we have no other solution and no funding to expand. Right. So, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smaldine.
Thank you, Senator Ringo, Richard Reed, and Senator Shields. I'm with Salem City Watch. I just have a couple of quick comments and talk to Bill, and he said I could go first.
Okay.
Senate Bill 307, obviously, I think a lot of us in the room are in favor of that. There's a lot of common sense associated with that, so I don't want to speak for that. But I did find Senate Bill 742 today and was looking it over, and it reminds me of assignments I get handed back from my teacher. It needs work, and I would just suggest that it not get out of committee. I'm very, very sympathetic with the need for funding schools, and I think that Senate Bill 307 does it, whereas Senate Bill 742 unnecessarily creates new law. ORS 223-299 is already the statutory basis. There's no reason to mess around with it. And then I have, I'll just send it in to you, but I have, there's some sections with Senate Bill 742 that are just way off the mark, and I don't think it'd be appropriate at this time anyway to open up any school district in the state to create some sort of impact fee and a methodology associated with it. So thanks again very, very much for having the hearing and bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thanks for coming to testify. Mr. Smaldine.
Thank you, Senator Ringo, Senator Shields. Thank you very much. I'd like to say, first of all, thanks for holding this hearing and allowing me to testify. And second, I would like to strongly urge members to support SB 307, which will allow Oregon communities to grow while simultaneously enhancing the quality of life for all citizens. From 1999 until 2002, I was a member of the Salem City Council representing Ward 2. During that time, my colleagues and I struggled with the long-term problem of Salem's continued rapid population growth and the concomitant increase in the demand for public services. Like many other local governments, Salem Council found that the growth of the city's revenues was not enough to maintain its park, fire, police, and library services, nor was it enough to maintain the city's streets and public buildings. Our problem was not a new one, and it also did not stem solely from the fact that the city draws no property tax revenue from the extensive state properties within its boundaries. The main problem goes back over 20 years, when federal revenue sharing dollars dried up and voters cut, capped, and limited the extent to which governments could increase property taxes. It became extremely difficult, if not impossible, for cities to keep up with the cost of growth through the use of general fund money. Property taxes from new residential development generally do not cover the public cost of building and maintaining the requisite infrastructure. The result is across-the-board strain in public in government services. One way in which communities have responded to this crisis is through the use of systems development charges as a means of recovering some or all of the cost of growth. Cities can level SDCs to help pay for some key infrastructural investments in such areas as water and sewer systems, streets, and parks. These charges take some of the strain off the city's general fund, which can then be used to pay for maintenance and operations. SDCs have not solved all of our problems related to growth, but they have proven to be an extremely useful tool to communities that no longer had the public money available to subsidize the cost of new development. It is my hope that you will support providing Oregon school districts with the same tools now used by city government. An SDC for schools would allow school districts to react to and plan for new growth more effectively. Implementing an SDC charge for schools would allow districts to accumulate the capital necessary for land purchases and building construction, and that would necessarily follow residential development. Rather than irregularly go to the voters for bonds to solve worsening overcrowding and its related problems, a district could use SDC revenue as necessary to meet demand. Once again, Salem provides a good example of the problem we face. Since 1992, the Salem-Kaiser School District has added 10 elementary schools, 5 middle schools, and 1 high school to accommodate a total of 11,000 new students. Most of this building was the result of a massive school bond passed a few years ago when the district was experiencing severe difficulties servicing this growth. With the construction of the new buildings now just completed, the district is projected to soon be at capacity as it absorbs over 25,000 new residents over the next decade. Having the ability to charge SDCs for new development would ease the financial strain on the district significantly and allow it to service its students more effectively. Finally, it should be noted that SDCs do not alter the cost of development. They shift a part of the cost from the district's taxpayer-supported general revenue to the developer. Thus, it reduces but rarely eliminates the public subsidy that covers the real cost of development. SDCs also do not necessarily result in an increase in overall housing costs, which depend on myriad factors that affect local housing markets. A developer certainly may wish to pass along the SDC to the consumer by raising the price of a new home, but at the same time, lower property taxes may increase the affordability of housing for new residents as well as those in older homes. I thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I have Lori Wimmer-Whalen. Excuse me, Lori Wimmer-Whalen, Tricia Smith. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Well, then, you get the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening. And committee member for the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen, representing 43,000 members of the Oregon Education Association. Everything that has been eloquently said before, we would simply like to say ditto. I can spare you my testimony in the interest of the hour, except to say our preference is for a bill to move that has as much political support as possible on the policy level. We kind of like the idea of school impact fees because of their flexibility and being controlled more by the district as the authority. But having said that, whichever one would have the best chance of passage would be our favorite bill. Thank you
very much.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, I'm Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and we too would like to testify in support of the concepts embodied in all three of these bills. We see that if we were going to write the bill, that there might be a little change in each of them. Our problems with Senate Bill 307 and Senate Bill 743 is that the county is involved in the decision making, and sometimes county governments do not have the same interest in schools as school districts do. So we like the idea of Senate Bill 742 allowing the school district to have the ability to set those fees for themselves without having to talk county commissioners into it. Beyond that, we agree with Ms. Wimmer-Whalen that the best bill is the bill that will pass. It's long past time to pass a legislation like this. As I was sitting listening to the testimony, Mr. Chair, I was attempting to count the number of districts that have increased enrollment in the last 5 years. I have a little chart from one of the other committees I picked up today, in fact, and 81 of the 198 school districts have increased enrollment in the last 5 years, and of that 81, 25 of them have increased enrollment above 10%. And so that is a significant number of school districts all over the state, not just the ones that we commonly think of in the metro areas experiencing this kind of growth. SDCs or impact fees would be helpful to all school districts that experience growth, and the ones today experiencing growth are not necessarily the ones we would have guessed 10 years ago. So this is a bill that should pass for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Completely agree. Senator Shields. Anything else for the good of the order? Okay. Well, let's close the public hearing on these bills. And the Senate Committee on Environment and Land Use is adjourned.